Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Full Tilt by Emma Scott, narrated by Nelson Hobbs and Caitlin Kelly. Part 1. Full Tilt. Noun. Poker. Playing emotionally instead of rationally. Making impassioned rather than logical decisions. Prologue. Jonah. 15 months ago. White light pierced my eyes. I struggled to keep them open, then gave in and let them fall shut again. I listened to the machines instead. Let their sound pull me out of unconsciousness. The beeping pulse was my heart. My new heart, pumping slowly in my chest. Yesterday, it belonged to a 23-year-old basketball player who'd been in a car accident outside Henderson. Now it was mine. Grief and gratitude danced at the edges of my awareness. Thank you. I'm sorry. And thank you. God, my chest. It felt as if an anvil had crushed me. Smashed my ribs. A great, swelling agony lurked underneath my sternum that had been cracked open like a cabinet, then stapled shut again. Somewhere, within the deep, heavy ache, was my new heart. I groaned, and the sound surged out of me, riding a current of pain. He's waking up. Are you waking up, honey? I forced my eyes open, and the light was merciless. Maybe I'm dead. The white of hospital sheets and stark fluorescence seared my eyes, then settled. Dark shapes took form. My parents hovered over me on my right. My mother's eyes were wet, and her hand reached to brush a lock of hair from my forehead. She adjusted the nasal cannula that was jammed up my nose, though it probably didn't need adjusting.
You look wonderful, sweetheart,
she told me in a tremulous voice. I felt like I'd been run over by a freight train, and before that, I'd been deathly sick for weeks. But she didn't mean I looked good. She meant I looked alive. For her sake, I managed to smile. You did good, son, my father said. Dr. Morrison said everything looks real good. He gave me a tight smile, then looked away, coughing into his fist to hide his emotion. Theo, I croaked, and winced at the deep bruise of pain in my chest. I breathed shallowly and looked for him on my left. He was there, crouched in a chair, his forearms resting on his knees. Strong. Solid. Hey, bro, he said, and I heard the forced lightness in his deep voice. Mom's pulling your leg. You look like shit.
Theodore, she said. He does not. He's beautiful.
I didn't have the energy to give my brother a joke. All I could manage was a smile. He smiled back, but it was tense and hard. I knew my brother better than anyone. I knew when something was eating at him. Anger burned in him like a pilot light, and now it was flaring hot. Why? I cast my gaze around the room, and then I knew.
Audrey?
The air tightened, and my mother jumped as if someone had poked her with a needle. Looks were exchanged all around me, like birds darting over my bed. It's late, my father said. She's gone home. He was a city councilman, and he turned on his politician's voice, the one he used when he needed to tell an unpleasant truth in a pleasant way. My mother, a kindergarten teacher and adept at comfort, swooped in.
But you should rest now, honey. Sleep. You'll feel stronger after you've had more sleep.
She kissed me on my forehead.
I love you, Jonah. You're going to be just fine.
My dad took my mom by the shoulders. Let's let him rest, Beverly. I rested. I fell in and out of fitful, pain-soaked sleep until a nurse tinkered with an IV in my arm. And then I slept deeply. When I awoke, Theo was there. Audrey was not. My new heart began to thump a dull, heavy pang. All the adrenaline circuits were reconnected, or whichever hormone it was that kicked in when something you thought might last forever was over. "Where is she?" I asked. "Tell me the truth." Theo knew whom I meant. "She left for Paris yesterday morning."
"You talked to her? What did she say?"
He pulled his chair closer. "Some fucking sob story. Now she had a plan for her life, and this..." His gaze swept the room.
"This wasn't it,"
I said. "She couldn't hack it." He tore his hand through his hair. "Fuck, I shouldn't have said anything."
"No,"
I said, shaking my head a little.
"I'm glad you told me. I needed to hear it."
"I'm sorry, bro. 3 years. 3 years you gave her, and she just..."
"It's okay. It's better."
"Better? How the hell is it better?" Already my eyes felt heavy and wanted to close, to drop the curtain and let me sink back into oblivion for a little while. I didn't have the strength to tell him that I didn't hate Audrey for leaving me. I had seen it coming. Even sick, with a rapidly failing heart, I could see how she twitched and jumped, eyes darting to the door, plotting an escape route from my illness and the life it would leave me. It hurt. I felt every one of those 3 years we'd been together, like a knife driven into my new heart. But I didn't hate her. I didn't hate her because I didn't love her. Not in the way I wanted to love a woman. With everything I had, Audrey was gone. Theo could hate her for me. My parents could marvel at her cruelty on my behalf. But I let her go. Because at that moment, I didn't know she'd be the last.
Chapter 1. Casey. July. A Saturday night. I was drunk. Why else would I have my cell phone in my hand, my thumb hovering over my parents' house number in San Diego? Drunk dialing, I thought. Not just for ex-boyfriends anymore. I snorted a laugh. It came out more like a sob and echoed around the stairwell. I sat in the dark, narrow space, knees pulled up, trying to make myself small. Invisible. On the other side of the cement wall, I could hear the muffled shouts and whistles of 3,000 people waiting for rapid confession to take the stage. Our manager, Jimmy Ray, had given us the 10-minute cue a good 20 minutes ago, and my bandmates were probably looking for me. I took a sip from my Evian water bottle, 3/4 filled with vodka, because I'm clever like that, and contemplated my phone. I dared myself to call. I warned myself not to, to just put it away and join the band in the green room. We'd hit the stage, play for yet another sold-out show. I'd get hella famous, make some serious money, and continue to screw a different guy every night. Because rock and roll... What a joke. I wasn't rock and roll. I looked the part, especially tonight, in my miniskirt, thigh-high boots, and bustier. My hair, bleached to almost white, curled around my shoulders in pin-up girl perfection. My lips painted red, and my eyes lined in black. Tattoos decorated my skin, adding to the impression of a grunge rock chick. But they weren't part of the costume. They were mine. I looked the part, but I felt like a piece of glass, shattered and scattered all over. I didn't know who or what I was anymore, but I glittered prettily in the spotlight. I took another sip of vodka and nearly dropped my phone. I fumbled to catch it, and when I lifted it up, I saw I'd hit that big green call button. Shit. Slowly, I put the phone to my ear. My mother answered on the third ring. "Hello, Dawson residence." My heart dropped into my stomach. My jaw worked, but I couldn't make any sound come out.
Hello? Hello, may I help you?
She's going to hang up. Hey, Mom, it's me, Casey.
Cassandra.
I hated that name, and I hadn't used it for years. But wrapped around those three syllables, I heard the relief in my mother's voice. I heard it.
Yeah, hi, I said brightly. Too loudly. How are you guys?
We are fine, she said.
Her voice was hushed now, as if she didn't want to be overheard.
Where are you calling from?
Las Vegas, I said. Because we're on tour, me and my band.
Rapid Confession? It's a sold-out show tonight, our second night in a row.
Actually, most of the shows on our tour have been sold out. It's pretty great. We're hitting the big time.
I am very happy for you, Cassandra.
I heard my father's influence behind my mother's words, turning her into a goddamn robot spouting lies she'd been forced to memorize. And our latest single, Talk Me Down, well, I bit my lip. It's number 6 on the Billboard Hot 100. And I
wrote it, Mom.
I mean, the band and I wrote it, but the words, they're mostly mine. And Wanderlust? I wrote that one too. It's number 12 on the charts.
Nothing.
I swallowed.
How is Dad?
He's fine,
my mother replied, her voice almost a whisper now.
Is he there?
My mom sighed, a tiny exhalation.
Cassie, are you safe? Are you taken care of?
I'm doing good, Mom, I said. And I'm a success. This band, we're a hit.
God, I hated this. The pathetic tone of my voice, the bragging of the band's accomplishments, begging my mother to feel happy for our success when I hardly felt a thing myself.
Except the need to be loved.
It was like a hunger that was never sated. A desperate starvation twisted and twined into my guts, tangled in ravenous knots I couldn't unravel. I could never quell that awful appetite. Only drown it in alcohol for a little while and try to puke it out the next day.
Mom, please, just tell Dad.
Cassie, I have to go.
Wait, can you put him on? Or just, can you tell him you're on the phone with me right now? Just do that, Mom. See what he says.
Silence.
I don't think that's a good idea, she said finally. He's been cheerful lately. No upsets. I don't want to disturb him.
Is he still mad at me? I asked, my voice wavering. It was 4 years ago, Mom. I'm not even with Chet anymore. Chet ditched me in Las Vegas 4 years ago, leaving me broke, heartbroken, and reeling. A cross-country tour, a record deal, countless one-night stands, and 2 new tattoos later. And here I was, a wayward kid again, begging her parents to forgive her. I fought back the tears.
I told you this, Mom. But did you tell him? Did you ever tell Dad I was homeless and sleeping at the Y when he kicked me out? Homeless, Mom. I was fucking 17 years old.
I heard her swallow hard, forcing down tears and emotions and everything she wanted to say, but never would. She hadn't told Dad anything about me other than I was still alive, that she had heard from me and I was doing well. She kept to her script. No matter how many times I begged her to try out some new material.
You should have known better than to bring that boy home,
my mother said, mustering a little firmness.
You knew how it would upset your father.
Everything I did upset him, I cried, my voice clanging around the stairwell. Nothing was ever good enough.
Yeah, I knew bringing Chet home was a bad fucking idea, but I wanted to get caught. Do you know why, Mom? To force Dad to talk to me. And how goddamn sad is that? His own daughter. His own child. Cassandra, I have to go now. I'll tell your father I heard from you and that I'm doing well, I finished. Not well, Mom, I snapped and wiped my nose on the back of my hand. We're a fucking sensation. We're the next big thing. You know I don't care for all this foul language, Cassandra, she said. Now her voice was turning to stone, walling me out. But I couldn't stop. You tell Dad that, okay? You tell him I made it. And that I did it without his fucking help or approval or his goddamn roof over my head. I'm going to hang up now, Cassandra. I sucked in a breath, instantly regretting every word. I needed to hear more of her voice. Mom, wait. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. The line was quiet, and I thought she'd hung up, until I heard her draw in a shaky little breath. I eased one of my own and closed my eyes. I'm sorry. Tell Dad. I swallowed down the tears. Tell him I love him, okay? Please? I will, she said, though I didn't believe it. Not for a second. Thanks, Mom. And I love you, too.
I have to get off now. Take care.
The line went quiet for good. I stared at my phone a few moments more. A tear splatted onto its face, and I wiped it away with my thumb. I thought about pressing the call button again. I could call her back and tell her I was sorry for swearing. Or I could call her back and say I wasn't fucking sorry at all. I was never calling again. I was as done with them as they were done with me. Are they done with me? The thought made my heart ache. No, not yet. My mother held on. She needed my phone calls. I knew that. But if I never called her again, she wouldn't call me. I knew that too. She was still a bystander in her own child's life. I slumped against the concrete wall. I could hear the crowd on the other side growing restless. It sounded like a thunderstorm moving closer. If we didn't take the stage soon, I needed a smoke. I pulled a battered soft pack of cigarettes from the top part of my thigh-high boot and lit it from a matchbook tucked into the cellophane. I drew in deep, exhaled, and slumped lower against the wall. Weighed down by all the tears I didn't cry over the last 4 years. They threatened to burst out now in my own thunderstorm. I battled it all back. Inhaled it hard. Wrapped it in smoke and pressed it into my gut, where it sat like a lead weight. Dad won't even talk to me. I exhaled the thought back out. So what? Who cares what he thinks? He's never given a shit in 22 years. Why would he start now? Fuck him. A brave speech. Except I would have given anything to hear my dad's voice. And not have it be laced with disappointment or anger. To hear him say he missed me or he loved me. To be told I could come home anytime I wanted and the door would be open. But he'd shut and locked that door, maybe forever, and the foundation on which I'd been built was crumbling to dust. The crowd roared on the other side of the wall. They were clamoring for us. For me. They loved me. And as Roxy Hart would say, I loved them for loving me. I took another pull from my vodka and rose from my crouch, just as Jimmy Ray busted through a door on the landing above mine, looking frantic and wound up.
Our manager was in his mid-40s, with thinning hair. His suit, always Armani since a mid-sized label signed us 3 months ago, hung a bit loose over his lanky frame. His wild eyes landed on me, and he collapsed against the wall in exaggerated relief, his hand over his heart.
Jesus, kitten. Give me a coronary, why don't you? The gig was supposed to start half an hour ago.
I grounded out the cigarette under the heel of my boot and plastered a smile on my face.
Sorry, Jimmy. I had an important phone call. But I'm good now. Ready to kick ass.
Glad to hear it. This crowd is going to eat us alive if we don't get out there. ASAP.
I moved past him, but he stopped me, his hand on my chin, studying my face.
You've been crying.
I sucked in a breath. Jimmy Ray wasn't anyone's idea of a father figure. But he'd been good to us. Good to me. I felt myself start to wilt under his kindness, wanting to tell him.
Because your makeup is smeared, he said. Make sure you fix it before you go on, yeah?
I nodded mutely.
That a girl.
He smacked my ass lightly to get me moving and followed me out of the stairwell. Back to the green room, where the rest of the band was waiting. Chapter 2 Casey. They were all dressed in full concert gear. Leather, vinyl, and lots of chunky costume jewelry. Violet, our bassist, wore her brown hair pulled tight to one side, revealing the small black raven tattooed in the shaved skin of her scalp above her ear. She gave me a nod and flashed me a peace sign. Lola, my best friend, sat in a deep chair, spinning her drumsticks deftly around her fingers. She jumped up and came to me, peered at my face through shocks of black and electric blue hair. Her dark eyes were sharp, observant, and full of concern.
You okay? Where'd you take off to?
I was spared answering by Jeannie, our lead singer. She'd been doing her vocal warm-ups, but stopped in the middle of a scale.
What the actual fuck, Casey?
Her eyes, lined in coal as black as her skin-tight leather pants, zeroed in on me. She was a pretty gal. Our fearless leader. Or would be if not for the perpetual constipated look on her face. I felt the weight of the room on me, heavy and accusatory. I crossed my arms over my chest, affected a pinched, slightly Midwestern older lady voice.
Hello, Jeannie, who's bothering you now?
Lola snickered, and Violet muffled a laugh behind her hand.
Who's bothering me? You!
Jeannie's confusion morphed to irritation.
Wait, are you quoting some stupid movie at me again?
Stupid? I gaped dramatically.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off is nothing short of a classic, a national treasure.
Jeannie flapped a hand, her bracelets jangling.
Whatever. If you devoted as much time to the band as you do to partying and watching 80s relics...
Come on, Jeannie, Violet said with a sigh. Let's not start any shit right before the show. She's here. We're fashionably late. So what? Lola nodded.
Only newbies start a show on time. She's ready to kick ass, right, Case?
Oh, stop coddling her, for Christ's sakes!
Jeannie snapped at Lola, and then Jimmy swooped in and pulled her aside, talking soothingly to her in a low voice. Under my breath, I said,
what a little asshole.
Violet burst out laughing, but Lola's eyes flickered to my Evian. She was a human breathalyzer, that girl. Quickly, I tossed the bottle in the trash before she got wind of its contents and laid another of her patented lectures on me. The vodka had already started to work anyway, putting me one giant step back from reality, as if I were behind a pane of glass.
Let's not fight, ladies.
Jimmy chided, bringing Jeannie back to the center of the green room.
3,000 paid ticket holders are waiting.
He's right, Jeannie said, and mustered what we called her fearless leader expression, stiff and serious as she eyed us in turn.
We need to get focused and give them the performance of our lives. Circle up.
We formed a ring in the center of the green room, holding hands, while Jeannie murmured a sort of vague invocation. Violet was a Buddhist, Lola an atheist, so the group prayer was more about channeling our energies, being grateful for our opportunities, and getting the four of us in tune with each other so we could play as one cohesive unit.
Was this what I wanted? I mused, while Jeannie droned positive affirmations.
I suspected the answer was no, but I'd come too far now. Lola was counting on me. If it hadn't been for her, I'd still be on the streets. She'd taken me in after Chet ditched me, and we'd gotten this gig together. She needed me to not fuck this up. And I needed to not be a fuck-up.
Forget every other show, Jeannie was saying, her typical closing statements. Forget we've been on the road for months. These fans deserve our best. So let's go out there and perform as if it were the first day of the tour. Blood, sweat, and tears, ladies.
We made loud noises of agreement to get amped up, then headed out. Lola pulled me aside.
Are you okay? For real?
Sure, I'm fine. Totally.
Where were you?
Oh, I called my parents.
Lola's shoulders slumped, and she covered her eyes with one hand.
Oh, shit. No. No, no, no. I keep telling you to give it up. It always bites you in the ass, Case, every time. You get all upset, then you get even more wasted than usual.
No. No, it was great, I said. I only talked to my mom, but... Well, my dad said hi.
I heard him in the background.
That's a start, right?
Is this where you're at?
Lying to your best friend after all that she's done for you? Lola looked shocked.
Really? He talked to you?
He said hi, Lola. He really did. Lola studied me through narrow eyes and finally relented.
That's great, Case, she said, hugging me. I'm really happy for you. To be honest, I've been worried lately. You party 24/7 and have a different guy in your bed every night.
Not every night, I said. I have my dry spells. Like Tuesday.
Lola snorted.
Let's go, girls.
Jimmy reappeared at the door.
They're waiting.
I flashed Lola a reassuring smile. We're going to kick ass at this show tonight, I promise.
I wish you'd promise not to party so fucking hard afterward. Maybe you'd be able to remember how kick-ass the show was.
I pretended to be affronted.
That is the least rock and roll thing I've ever heard in my life. Keith Richards would roll over in his grave if he heard you talk like that.
A smile twitched Lola's lips.
Keith Richards isn't dead.
See? Nothing to worry about. She rolled her eyes and laughed, slinging her arm around me. Protectively, as always. Hugo Williams, the Pony Club's head of security, appeared at the green room door to escort us to the stage. His dark eyes were warm and kind as he smiled at me, his teeth white and bright against the dark of his skin.
Hey, Hugo, I said as we filed out.
Hey, sweets,
he said in his deep baritone. This was only our second night at the Pony Club, but Hugo seemed extra considerate of me, going out of his way to make sure I felt safe.
Jimmy slung an arm over my bare shoulders.
Sounds like a rowdy crowd tonight, Hugo.
I smiled up at the bodyguard.
Hugo'll take care of me. He's my hero.
The big bodyguard nodded, like a soldier given an order, and led us to the stage. We took winding back hallways with pipes running along the ceiling. Our footsteps clapped and echoed on the cement. Jimmy turned to me.
You ready?
Born ready, Jimmy.
That's my girl.
I joined my bandmates at a short flight of stairs that led to the stage. A roar went up, the crowd responding to the MC taking the mic.
Las Vegas,
Are you ready for rapid confession?
Another wave of sound, like an avalanche ripping apart the walls of the venue. The door opened, a dark rectangle blazing with stage lights. We streamed up the short flight of stairs and onto the stage. My red Fender was waiting for me on a stand. I looped the strap over my shoulder and saw Jeannie throw me a nod and a nervous smile.
A peace agreement.
I nodded and smiled back. Agreement accepted. Lola clashed her drumsticks over her head in a four-count lead-in to talk me down.
I played my goddamn heart out.
I wrote Talk Me Down for myself. It was an anthem to everything that scared me about where I was going and what I was doing to myself. Nobody knew it was mine. I sang backup to Jeannie's melody. But when I played, my heart came out. The music carved open my chest, flayed my ribs, and showed the world everything inside. I shredded my solos. All the liquor I'd drunk on an empty stomach turned the stage lights into blurry orbs of white. The faces in the crowd melted together, becoming one roaring, churning, electric mass. I fed off the energy, sucking in their screaming approval and spitting it back out with every chord and progression until my fingers bled. And at the end of the show, I nearly smashed my Fender onto the stage. As the last notes of the last song vibrated in the air and then vanished, the crowd lost its collective shit. I was lit up like the 4th of July, running along the lip of the stage, slapping hands with the front row audience. They grabbed and pulled me over the edge. I laughed and laughed, surfing on a wave of adoring hands, drunk as hell and high on being loved. The boulder of Hugo and his team rolled into the crowd, hauled me down, and marched me out. But I didn't want it to end. I called to the crowd around me. I love you all so much. Come back with me. I pointed at random strangers. Come with me. Let's keep the party going. Hugo dragged me to the green room where the band was celebrating. Champagne spewed through the air in gold and foamy arcs. I grabbed a bottle out of someone's hand and downed half of it in one draft. I shouted at security to let in the small crowd I'd invited. They're with me, I cried. About 24 pushed their way in. My bandmates were all too high on the heady success of the show to care. Jimmy looked like he was going to fly straight off the ground. Tossing the champagne aside, I grabbed a bottle at random from the long table of post-show food and drink. Jägermeister. A bold choice, I thought with a laugh, and let out a scratchy whoop after the liquor burned its way down my throat. The room, filled with my new friends, cheered back. Strange faces I didn't recognize, whom I'd never remember tomorrow. People who were here for the music and the free booze and the entertainment, and for me. Their matron saint of good times. I climbed onto the table, and they cheered and raised their bottles to me. They love me. The room began to spin as if I were on a carousel. It was too packed in here. No air. Security was trying to squeeze in through the wall of bodies. Glass shattered. Some in the crowd cheered, while others cursed. Lola yelled for me to get down before I broke my ass, then was lost in the crowd. The huge, hulking shape of Hugo parting the sea like Moses. I tried to lift the emerald green bottle to my lips for one final slug because this party was exploding and I was going to hit bottom and shatter into a million pieces. My father's words, 4 years ago, resounded in my head with just as much clarity as if it were yesterday.
Get out. Get out of my house.
No, I said. Then louder, blearily, my mouth thick and clumsy around the words. You get out. This is my house. My house.
I raise my bottle in the air.
This is my house,
I screamed, and 100 million voices raised their own bottles and cheered me on until the sound tore through me like wind through tissue paper. I laughed, or maybe cried, then staggered sideways. The liquor bottle slipped from my fingers just as I slipped from the table, straight into Hugo's waiting arms. I saw the blackness of his t-shirt, then the blackness behind my eyes swallowed me whole.
Chapter 3 Jonah. The sign above me blinked off and on, red and white. Pony Club. The edges of the metal were rusted, and three of the bulbs lining the edge were burnt out. It looked cheap, gaudy, like a lot of Vegas. But when I squinted, the lights blurred and I could imagine globes of white and red glass. Glass beads, maybe. A bundle of them held together with wire to make a bouquet. My mind pulled the red beads out long, making flattened petals. A poinsettia, with white baby's breath. A Christmas bouquet of glass that never needed watering. My mother would like that. Or maybe Dina. I started to pull out the battered little notepad I kept in the front pocket of my shirt to jot the idea down, then stopped. Christmas was 6 months away. A soft ache tried to take root, and I squashed it with practiced ease, like a lump of gum pressed under a table. Keep to the routine. I withdrew my hand and left the notepad where it was. It was now getting loud in the Pony Club. The show had supposedly ended an hour ago, but the shouts and whoops of some epic party were loud and clear, if muffled, through the cement of the venue's back wall. I pulled my cell phone from the pocket of my uniform slacks to check the time. It was nearly 1 a.m. The limo was commissioned only until 2, but I could already tell this was going to be a night of enforced overtime. But what did I care if the job ran late? I didn't sleep much these days, and I could use the money. I'd stay until the band and their manager came oozing out of the venue, wasted and reeking, and take them back to the mega mansion in Summerlin, where I'd pick them up at 5 that evening. The upside to driving at night was it left me time to work during the day. The downside was the downtime. So many empty hours spent waiting for my fare to get done with dinner or the show, or to finally emerge from the casino, stinking of booze and smoke and, more often than not, mourning their losses at the blackjack or poker tables. Limo drivers tended to band together at events, lined up outside the venue in a train of sleek black or white vehicles. I saw the same faces at different jobs, and some were my own coworkers at A1 Limousine. But I had to avoid smoke, and I wasn't interested in making new buddies. I kept myself to my routine. I leaned against the limo and looked up. No stars could conquer the lights of Vegas. I'd have to wait until my best friend's Great Basin camping trip in a few weeks to see actual stars. But the Strip was its own kind of constellation. A riot of garish neon color and glittering lights. It was beautiful in its own way, as long as you didn't look down. At my feet, in the gutter running between the street and sidewalk, were cigarette butts, a crushed soft drink cup from Dairy Queen, and a flyer for a nudie show off the Strip. Shattered glass glittered green under a street lamp. One of the other limo drivers approached me. "Got a smoke?" This guy was young, younger than my 26 years anyway. Sweat beaded his brow as he looked at me hopefully. Even in this summer heat, he was still wearing his service's livery, a maroon polyester jacket with gold piping. Newbie. My black jacket was on the front seat, and had been since the band and their manager exited my limo nearly 8 hours ago. "I don't smoke, man," I told him. "Sorry." The sorry was code for conversation over, but this guy didn't catch on. "Shit, I ran out an hour ago," he muttered. His name tag read Trevor. "Hey, who you driving for?" I got a bunch of sweet 16 Richies seeing the rapid confession show. He barked a laugh. Spoiled rich brats. I mean, what's worse than that? I can't imagine, I muttered. My phone vibrated with a text. Probably my brother Theo, with the hourly check-in. I pulled the phone from my pants pocket. Yep. What's up? You good? Rolling my eyes, I took a screenshot of the midnight check-in, the exact same message and my reply that I was fine. I hit send. He texted back, Dick. I smirked, typing, You make it so easy. Go to sleep, Teddy. I'll call you in the morning. I wonder who has the band, Trevor said, glancing down the line of limos. If I had those bitches, it would be epic. Night made. Another photo text came in, this one of Theo's middle finger. He hated when I called him Teddy, almost as much as I hated it when guys called women bitches. I turned to Trevor to tell him to get lost, when the Ponies Club back door banged open, and the sound of raucous laughter, shouts, and shattered glass spilled onto the street. A huge bodyguard hurried out, carrying the limp body of a woman. Her leather skirt hiked up her thighs, and her head hanging so that her blonde hair spilled over the bodyguard's arm. I gave Trevor a little shove out of the way and opened the limo's passenger door. The bodyguard never broke stride, but bent his hulking form over to lay the girl inside, on the long leather seat that ran opposite the door. Trevor sucked in a breath. That's her. The blonde. The guitar player for RC. He looked at me like I was his hero. You have them? The bodyguard reemerged from the limo and towered over Trevor, his hands balling into fists. Is this your business? Trevor cringed and backed off. No, sir. Are you going to tell anyone what you saw here? No, I sure won't. Good answer. He turned back to me. Take her home, quick, before the paparazzi show up. It's a fucking riot in there. He jerked his head toward the venue, where the shouts were louder, punctuated by shrill cursing and more breaking glass. I gotta get back. He jabbed a finger into my chest. You make sure she gets home safe. I saw the concern bright in the guy's dark eyes boring into mine. Then he was loping back to the venue. Sirens wailed in the distance, getting closer. With the huge bodyguard gone, Trevor crept forward, peering into the limo. Dude, she is smoking hot. I had to agree with Trevor's assessment, but the girl was also passed out drunk. Women needed to be coherent and conscious for me to entertain even fleeting sexual thoughts. Trevor's tongue was lolling out of his mouth, and I slammed the door shut, disgusted, cutting off his view. What are you going to do with her? Trevor asked. I paused at the driver's side door to stare. I'm going to take her home, asshole. Trevor held up his hands. Jeez, chill out. I didn't hear the rest as I climbed into the car and shut my door. Trevor wasn't going to keep his promise to the bodyguard about the girl on the back seat. No chance. And the news of whatever happened in the Pony Club was going to hit the streets anyway. The sirens were guarantee of that. Just get her home, finish the job, keep to your routine. I pulled the limo away from the curb. I hit traffic on the strip and lowered the partition to check on the girl. Her skirt was still hiked up, showing a fishnet-clad thigh and part of a tattoo. More inked patterns snaked up the pale skin of her forearms, and a larger one covered her right shoulder. The rounded tops of her breasts were pushing out of the bustier thing she wore. But I was looking for her chest to move, to show me she was breathing. I wondered if I should veer to the Sunrise Hospital, my home away from home, when the girl gave a groan and rolled to her side. I watched the streets in front of me while listening to her heave what sounded like a barrel's worth of booze onto the limo floor. The smell of regurgitated liquor filled the confined space. Awesome, I muttered. This is why they pay me the big bucks. When she was done retching, the girl, the guitar player, according to Trevor, slumped back on the seat to moan softly, her eyes still closed, her white blonde hair sticking to her cheek. I turned off the strip, found a dark, empty side street, and pulled over. I climbed in the back, where my fare lay sprawled on the long seat, stepping around the mess on the floor to sit near her head to brush the hair from her face. I hated to agree with Trevor about anything, but this girl was beautiful. Even passed out drunk and reeking of booze, puke, and cigarette smoke, she was stunning. Large eyes fringed with long dark lashes, broad mouth with full lips painted a deep red, and dark-shaped brows that contrasted with her white blonde hair. I reminded myself I was there to make sure she wasn't going to die on me, not waste time ogling her. I'd had a lot of pretty girls in my limos over the last few months. Lots of drunk, pretty girls. This one was no different. This girl, I wished I'd thought to get her name from the bodyguard, was breathing better and some color had returned to her face. Upchucking a fifth of liquor probably helped. Satisfied that she didn't need a hospital, though I didn't envy the epic hangover she was going to wake up to, I concentrated on getting her home so I could call it a night. I drove northeast to the Summerlin neighborhood. The big house was a pale peach color with white columns and a circular drive, and it was totally dark. Shit. I got out of the limo and rang the front bell, hoping someone's personal assistant or maybe another security guard was around. Nothing. I tried the front door on the off chance that it had been left unlocked. It wasn't. I went back to the limo and fished out my cell phone from my pocket and called A1's dispatch. Tony Politino was working the lines. Tony, it's Jonah. I need the contact number for the rapid confession job. You got that job? Tony let out a wolf whistle. Lucky bastard. Not as lucky as the cleaning crew, I muttered. You got the number or not? Hold up. I rubbed my eyes and waited until Tony came back on. Jimmy Ray, he's their manager, he said. He droned the number. And hey, sneak a few pics for me, right? The blonde? She's fucking smoking. I glanced at the girl sprawled on the back seat. An insidious thought crept in. I could take a few pics of her, sell them to a gossip rag, and make a killing. I'd lose my job, of course, but with the money from the photos, I wouldn't need it. I could spend all day, every day, at the hot shop, and never have to worry if my installation would be finished on time for the gallery opening in October. It was a nice fantasy, except for the small fact that I'd never forgive myself for being such a low-life scumbag. That I'd even entertained the idea was repulsive. I chalked it up to tiredness, along with the heavy pang of dread that lurked behind every waking thought, ready to ooze out if I let it. The fear that told me I was running out of time, and the installation would be left forever unfinished. Keep to the routine, I muttered. What's that, bro? Tony asked. Nothing. Thanks for the number. I hung up on Tony and called Jimmy Ray, the band manager. I remembered him. He stuck out like a flashy used car salesman in my memory. A skinny middle-aged guy who dressed and acted like he was a decade younger, trying to be slick. He talked to the women in the band as if they were his meal ticket instead of human beings. Jimmy Ray answered the phone on the fifth ring, but talking was impossible. Loud music blasted from behind him, and the chaotic sounds of 100 voices shouting and screaming almost drowned him out.
Hello? What? What?
Mr. Ray, I had to shout. I'm your driver.
What? I can't hear a fucking thing.
I'm from A1 Limousine. Who the fuck is this? I rubbed my eyes. Elvis Presley. Rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated.
Look, whoever this is, I've got a damn catastrophe on my hands. Call me back.
More shouting, and then it all turned muffled. The guy had probably put the phone in his pocket without hanging up. I ended the call on my end and checked the time. Just after 2 a.m. On the darkened street, no lights heading my way, no one coming home. I glanced inside at the nameless girl. What am I going to do with you? The urge to take her back to the pony club and hand her back to the bodyguard was a strong one. But that poor bastard probably had his hands full. I shut the passenger door to the limo and got back behind the wheel. This whole scene felt seedy and wrong. I wanted to get her someplace safe, and while taking her to my apartment wasn't exactly kosher, it was better than seeing her splayed out drunk in the back of a puke-splattered limo. I hope you realize this is highly irregular, I told her as I navigated out of the Summerlin Estates. Totally not in the employee handbook. In fact, I seem to recall watching an educational video about this sort of thing. How not to get sued into oblivion. Step one, don't take your fares home with you. Especially if they are of the blacked-out, drunk, and female persuasion. At 2 in the morning, Vegas showed its dark underbelly. The streets were filled with the most desperate. Gamblers hoping to salvage some of their losses. Hopeless drunks, drug dealers, and prostitutes. This was the Vegas I hated. But as I crossed the strip, heading east, I passed the Bellagio. My smile returned. There was real beauty in Las Vegas. You just had to know where to look. The Bellagio's lobby ceiling was one place. In my rear view was another. The girl passed out on the long seat, threw one tattooed arm over her eyes, and gave a little moan. We're almost there, I told her gently. You're going to be okay. Chapter 4 Jonah. I pulled the limo to the front of my apartment complex. I lived in a cement box of a building, with pale gray stucco and crooked railings, peeling lime green paint. I know it's not the luxury villa you're used to, I told her. But beggars can't be choosers, am I right? The girl, still deep in her booze-soaked nap, wasn't in a position to choose anything. I parked the limo alongside of the building, as close to my first-floor apartment as I could get. Illegally parked, but hidden from the street. I jogged to my front door, unlocked it, and opened it, and flipped on the light near the door. Back at the limo, I climbed in and sat beside the girl. Hey, I said, nudging her arm gently. Hey, can you wake up for me? She didn't stir. Shit. I heaved a breath. All right, here we go. She was a slight thing, maybe 5'5", and couldn't have weighed more than 110. But the alcohol had turned her to dead weight. Her limbs were limp and her head lolled. I struggled to get her out of the damn limo without banging her head on the door. I hoped to half carry, half walk her inside, but she was like jelly, oozing out of my arms. I sucked in a deep breath and lifted her under her knees and back, cradling her, so that her head rested against my chest. Dr. Morrison would have a conniption if he saw me lifting an entire human being. Theo would lose his shit. But neither of them were there now. Another perk about the night shift. Aside from a text or 10 from Theo, I was free of the scrutiny that only reminded me of my predicament when I was trying to put it aside and keep to my schedule. I carried the girl through the open door of my place and kicked it shut behind me with my heel. I laid her on the couch and sat beside her to catch my breath. I was winded, but it wasn't bad. A few deep breaths, and I was back in business. That wasn't so tough now, was it? The girl's full lips were parted, and she was breathing easy, a thin sheen of sweat over her forehead and across her chest. I couldn't imagine she could be very comfortable in those boots and bustier. Not that I was about to do anything about it. It was bad enough. I had her in my apartment. Even taking her shoes off might add fuel to whatever PR nightmare was awaiting me tomorrow. I wondered if I could lose my job over this. Over her. Now that she was safe, I spared a thought for my situation. I needed my job. I had the perfect routine going, and I couldn't let one goddamn thing throw it. I was supposed to go back to the pony club to pick up the band, like I'd been hired to do. But then what? bring them all back here to get their guitarist? And was it a good idea to leave her alone in the first place? I looked at the girl. Young woman. I guessed, maybe 22. She was out cold, but her beautiful face was at peace, her brows unfurrowed for the first time all night. I sighed. It's late. Let her sleep. I called A1 back and told Tony I had the stretch, and would have it back at the garage by 7 a.m. Tony warned me that our boss, Harry, would lose his shit to know one of his cars was out. Not to mention, I had left the band stranded at the Pony Club.
But then again, Harry fucking loves you, Tony said. You're his favorite driver.
That was true, which was why I was entrusted with the rapid confession job in the first place. Still, I was taking a huge fucking risk with my job. A job I desperately needed. With a frustrated groan, I chucked the phone onto my old junker of a coffee table in front of the couch. It clanked against one of three blown glass pieces sitting on its scratched wooden surface. From the hall closet, I retrieved an afghan and draped it over my houseguest, then set a glass of water and two aspirin from my personal miniature pharmacy on the table beside her. A peace offering, should the girl wake up and wonder if she'd been kidnapped by a crazed, knick-knack-collecting psycho. The girl, if I called her that one more time, even in my own mind, I was going to lose it. My laptop was on the kitchen counter that overlooked the living room. I opened it up and typed rapid confession into the Google search bar. A bunch of photos and articles came up, many of them as recent as yesterday. The band was about to explode on the music scene like a Molotov cocktail, according to Spin. And was the best thing to happen to rock and roll since the Foo Fighters, so speaketh Rolling Stone. I scrolled until I found cheeky promotional photos naming each band member. Casey Dawson, I muttered. Hallelujah. I stared at the promotional pic, even flipping the bird with an I don't give a fuck expression on her face. Casey Dawson was breathtaking. Get a grip, Fletcher. I snapped the laptop shut and headed for the bedroom. On the kitchen wall, the phone's answering machine was blinking insistently. I hit the playback button.
You have 3 new messages.
I should have just gone to bed.
Hey, Jonah, it's me, Mike Spence, from Carnegie. Look, I know you're going through some heavy shit now, but let's hang out, man. Let's grab a beer for old time's sake. Or at the very least, call me back and...
I jabbed delete, and the machine moved on to the next.
Hello, honey, it's Mom. Just calling to see how you are. I really do hate your late hours. I know I sound like a broken record, but, well, call me in the morning, and we'll see you for dinner on Sunday as usual. Your father wants to barbecue. Call me, sweetheart. I love you. Okay. Love you. Bye.
I erased that one, too, wishing I could erase the tentative tone in my mother's voice as easily. She sounded like she was always bracing herself for bad news. The final message played, this one having come in just a few minutes ago. Maybe while I was unloading my unconscious cargo from the limo. I knew it would be Theo even before I heard his voice.
Hey, bro. Just checking in. Call me back. Later.
Theo sounded casual, but the time of his call and earlier texts gave him away. Irritation flared, but I battled it back. Maybe Theo was working late at Vegas Inc. Sometimes he had clients coming in at all hours. Or maybe he was out late on a date. I couldn't keep track of his women. They came in and out of his life so quickly. I erased the message, just as a text came in on my cell. I grabbed it off the coffee table while Casey Dawson slept on, oblivious. Theo.
Still at work?
Now I rolled my eyes as the irritation took root. I jabbed a text. No, I'm out chain-smoking Marlboro Reds and eating raw steak.
Very funny. Home?
I sighed and contemplated the blank space, my thumb itching to tell him off, to quit hovering over me and leave me alone. I jabbed a few words to that effect, then backspaced the text away with a sigh. I didn't get to be pissed off anymore. Not on the outside, anyway. not at him or my parents. My whole situation was shitty enough without making them feel worse. Yes, I'm home now, I texted. Good night, Theo. See you at shop on Sunday. I'm sure I will, I muttered. I silenced the phone and left it on the kitchen counter on the way to the bedroom. There I changed out of my limo livery and laid it out on the bed that was neatly made and probably slightly dusty. I changed into a white wife beater and sleep pants from the plain wooden dresser, then headed to the bathroom in the hall to take a piss and brush my teeth. I brushed and made plans. Take Casey back to the Summerlin house first thing in the morning. Return the limo to A1 and get my truck. Go back to my routine. No problem. One little speed bump, that's all tonight had been. In the living room, Casey Dawson looked to be sleeping comfortably, or as comfortable as one could get in leather and vinyl. I remembered from my own college days that being hungover and sweating out last night's booze was a rotten combo. I turned the AC unit at the window on and settled into the reclining chair across from the couch. I had to laugh at the scene that would greet my guest should she wake up in the middle of the night, a dinky apartment instead of her mega mansion, and a strange dude sleeping in a recliner not 5 feet away instead of in the bed like a normal person. Stephen King should take notes, I muttered, settling into the halfway lying down position my doc recommended. This'll teach you to drink your options away, Casey Dawson, I muttered as my eyes drifted shut. Everything in moderation. Like my sleep. I woke up at 6, my ass numb from sitting in the same position all night. Not being able to change positions sucked, but I never slept much anyway, and I always came awake sharp and alert. It was as if my body knew time was no longer a luxury I could afford to waste. I steered my thoughts toward something positive. Sunlight, yellow and sharp, slanted in from the front window. The glass bottles and paperweights caught it, captured it, and sprayed it out on the coffee table in mottled reds, blues, and purples. Beautiful, I murmured, and I had the entire Saturday at the hot shop before me to create more. The figure on the couch moaned and sighed in her sleep, reminding me with a small jolt I had some unfinished business to take care of first. I threw off the light blanket and moved to the couch. Crouching beside Casey Dawson, I studied her sleeping face a moment. Hey. She didn't stir. Her mouth was slightly open. Dead to the world. I'm going to take a shower, I told her. Don't steal anything. I pondered writing her a note to tell her she wasn't kidnapped, but then this probably wasn't the first time Casey Dawson woke up after a hard night of partying, not knowing where she was. I left it to chance and took my shower. She was still out cold when I reemerged, dressed in jeans and a plain t-shirt, my hot shop uniform. At precisely 7 a.m., I took my meds, choking down one pill after another. 15 in all. My stomach complained instantly, and I got to work making the equally stomach-churning protein shake I drank every morning. Sorry, Casey. This is going to hurt, I muttered, and hit the button on my blender, filling my small apartment with a god-awful buzzing. The massively hungover Casey Dawson stirred, groaned, and finally sat up, pushing her tousled hair out of her eyes. She looked around blearily, not seeing me in the kitchen behind her, watching her. I didn't know it then. I couldn't have. But in that moment, the rest of my life, or what was left of it, began.
Chapter 5 Casey.
Someone was cutting down a tree. Fuck that, a whole forest. What kind of sick bastard?
I lifted my head, blinking hard. The whirring sound stopped, and my hazy gaze was drawn to the coffee table and its array of colorful glass paperweights. They were pretty. Beautiful, even. But my appreciation was lost as they refracted the sunlight straight into my eyeballs. Shifting my gaze, I saw a glass filled with water.
two aspirin tablets beside it. I sat up, ever so slowly, and a hideous orange and green knitted afghan fell off my shoulders. I glanced down at myself. Still 100% dressed. Even my boots. Dignity intact. Score one for me. But the thought didn't bring me any comfort. Here I was again, waking up in strange surroundings after a night of drinking I didn't remember. On a couch this time. But it could have been a trash-strewn alley. Or the proverbial ditch mothers are always warning their kids they'd turn up in if they weren't careful. I wasn't careful. I was never careful. It hurt too much to move or look around. It hurt to blink. I focused my attention on swallowing the aspirin down, chasing them with water. My mouth felt as dry and dusty as the Nevada desert. I would have chugged the whole glass if I thought my stomach could handle it. But I had my doubts. I took a few deep breaths and waited until the churning feeling in my gut subsided. Then glanced around at my immediate surroundings. A small apartment, sparsely decorated with plain, mismatched furniture. On the other side of the coffee table and its glass knickknacks was an old lazy boy chair facing a flat-screen TV. The walls were bare, but for two framed degrees from universities I couldn't read from the couch, and a half-dozen photos. The front windows showed a view of a busy Vegas street. Nothing about the place made any kind of impression on me, nor was it familiar. Well, I'm not chained up and the door is 3 feet away, I muttered to myself, and raised the water glass for another drink.
True on both counts.
I coughed the water all over my chest and looked around. The hell? A guy stood in the tiny kitchen behind me. His dark hair was wet, fresh from a shower, and his sharp brown eyes regarded me with dry bemusement. He was tall, super cute, and totally not my type. I liked the thick, loose curls of his hair, but he was too clean-cut for me. My men were tatted and pierced and came with an exit strategy in their back pocket after I slept with them. The guy in the kitchen looked like he made breakfast for any woman who stayed over, and instead of kicking them out, told them to make themselves at home. Nice guy, all caps. But God, he had a sweet face. A face I could have sworn I'd seen before. I searched the boozy depths of my memory for when and where.
I'm your limo driver, he said. I took you and your band to the pony club last night.
Oh, right, I said. That's it. The guy came around to the front of the kitchen counter, facing the living room, and leaned against it, arms crossed.
Jonah Fletcher.
What? My brain thudded behind my eyes in time to my pulse.
My name, he said slowly, is Jonah Fletcher. In case you were wondering on whose couch you were sitting.
Oh, sorry, I replied, my cheeks burning. I was just listening to my headache. I'm Casey Dawson, though you probably already knew that. Jonah's eyes widened slightly into bemusement, and I shook my head, a movement I regretted instantly. I don't mean because I'm famous or anything. I mean because of your job. My name's probably on some paperwork. Forget it. I held my aching head in my hands and tried to recall something from last night. A vague sense of something not very good happening added to the misery of my hangover. I peered up at Jonah Fletcher. Last night, did we... He arched one eyebrow at me, perfectly. The other didn't even move.
Did we what?
I huffed. Do I have to spell it out? The stiff, sharp expression on his face softened slightly.
We didn't. You were passed out.
He cocked his head.
You don't remember anything?
Not much.
Happens a lot?
I snorted.
I can't see how that's your business.
And yet, last night it became my business.
He shrugged.
Seems like a dangerous habit, is all. Not all guys are as nice as me.
That has yet to be determined. I muttered and glanced around.
This is your place? Why not take me back to the Summerlin house? Oh, believe me, I tried. Bringing you here isn't exactly work protocol. I could lose my job.
What happened? I asked, mostly because I should, not because I wanted to know. This guy, Jonah, rubbed his chin thoughtfully and came to sit across from me in a beat-up reclining chair. The chair's upholstery might have been brown leather, but I'd guess it was more likely vinyl, cracked in places and well-worn. Jonah sat in it and hung his arms off his jean-clad knees. A heavy silver bracelet ringed his right wrist. His t-shirt fit tight around his shoulders and biceps. Nice muscles. Lean, but defined. My eyes drifted to the collar of his shirt, to take in some of his chest. A quarter inch of a fleshy red line peaked above the seam. Some kind of gnarly scar. I quickly averted my eyes.
I tried to take you back to the house, Jonah was saying. Tried to get in touch with your manager, too. No luck. It was either bring you here or back to the pony club. But your bodyguard seemed pretty insistent I get you away from that scene.
A lump of dread joined the churning in my guts. What scene, exactly?
Not sure. It sounded like there was some sort of riot going on.
A riot. Whatever blood was left in my face drained out. A vague memory, blurry and soaked in booze, swam up. Me, urging a bunch of fans to the green room. I couldn't remember the actual moment, but the sound of so many cheering voices thundered in my head and made it ache harder. Did Hugo, the bodyguard, did he say what happened? How it started? Jonah shook his head.
You don't recall anything?
Pretty sure I don't want to, I said, my voice hardly a whisper. I fished around in the top part of my boots for my pack of smokes. I shook a cigarette out and was fumbling with the little matchbook when Jonah cleared his throat.
This is a no-smoking zone, if you don't mind.
Have mercy, I said with a wan smile. Besides, everyone smokes in Vegas.
I don't.
The hard tone in Jonah's voice froze my hand.